The Big Picture, a Christian insight into the world of movies, television and pop culture with magazine editor Ben McKechin and scriptwriter Mark Hadley. A Bible Society Australia production, sharing the light of God's Word into every corner of your world.
Top of the end of the week to you. I'm Ben McKechin.
And I'm his Vulcan ambassador, Mark Hadley. Welcome to episode 69 of The Big Picture for the week beginning July 24. And coming up on today's show, why parents need to know that Batman the Killing Joke is not what they think it is.
And there's a Jane Austen reimagining at cinemas, Mark. Love and Friendship cordially invites your attention.
Plus, Ewan McGregor and Homeland's Damian Lewis in holiday spy mission, Our Kind of Traitor.
But, mate, before we get to that, and warm wishes to you and
hello.
Nice to see you, etc. and all that, how you been? All right, good. Now we're over that. Now we've got past that. Let's get on to more important matters. Like, what else is happening this week? Let me tell you, Mark.
Do tell.
Something else at cinemas at the moment is a little movie you might like to call Sing Street. It is a very little movie in the scheme of things like Independence Day and Finding Dory and The Legend of Tarzan. This might have fallen through the cracks for you, but if you're a fan...
Oh, so it's not of that level.
It's not of that level. No, it is an actual small movie. It's set in Dublin back in the 80s. It's basically a coming-of-age story of a guy forming his own New Romantics band, so a band kind of like Duran Duran or Depeche Mode and that sort of thing. It's from the guy who made the film Once... and also Begin Again, which I know you're a big fan of. I'm a big fan of Once. So if you've seen either of those two movies, you'll like that. I think you'll like Sing Street. It's not amazing, but it is great, particularly if you like any classic 80s music that's featured in the movie, and there's a lot of it.
Okay. Did you like Almost Famous?
Yeah, not as much as you.
How about Jerry Maguire?
Not as much as you.
Gosh, everybody loved those films. Well, look, okay. For
apart from
all
me.
Reasonable film fans, Cameron Crowe, you know, who produced Almost Famous and Jerry Maguire, has his new television series releasing on Stan in the last fortnight, Roadies.
Oh, you've heard about this.
Yeah, Roadies Season 1 is the first six episodes in the pilot are directed by Crowe, and it's executive produced by J.J. Abrams, and it follows the day-to-day life of a successful rock tour, offering an inside look into the lives of a committed group of people who basically live for music and get music up on the stage for all of us. So the new episodes are fast-tracked from the US every Monday on Stan.
Mate, also at cinemas, not right at the moment though, but coming very soon, this Thursday in fact, a little movie you might like to call Jason Bourne.
Oh,
Jason
yes.
Bourne, Matt Damon. It's like Matt Damon couldn't get another role, even though he's been in plenty of movies the last couple of years, but still he's decided he's going to go back in as amnesiac assassin Jason Bourne in a movie now titled Jason Bourne for this fourth installment. He's reunited with director Paul Greengrass, and I believe Tommy Lee Jones is showing up in this movie, and he may be Jason Bourne's dad. That is that is one reason, just one, to go along to Jason Bourne. I am pumped. I really want to see this. We'll be talking about it on the show next week.
Okay, and I don't know where to go with this. The Checkout Season 4 is actually one of my favorite TV programs, and this takes a lot for me to say this because it's put together by Julian Morrow and Craig Rucastle from The Chaser team, and I'm not a big fan of the Chasers' work for a lot of different reasons, but The Checkout is brilliant TV. Season 4 starts Thursday, July 28, 8 p.m. on ABC and iView. It is basically from cradle to grave, we all struggle because we're all consumers, and we have the right or not right to remain silent every time somebody seems to rip us off. Each week, The Checkout takes a no-holds-barred, an irreverent, entertaining approach to explaining and exposing the ways that all of us are being ripped off at the cash register, so well worth a look.
In entertainment news, Mark, on the sequel front, Wreck-It Ralph is heading back to big screens, and this time he's going to wreck the internet. That's about the only plot description that's been unveiled as yet, but Wreck-It Ralph 2 is coming, but you're going to have to pencil in your diaries March 22, 2018, because that if you're a Wreck-It Ralph fan and you're a fan of the original animated film, if you want to see the sequel, you're going to have to wait till March 22, 2018, but it is coming.
Start the countdown now. Okay, are you ready, Star Wars fans? I can't hear you. Okay. I'll go on anyway. Well, in a galaxy not too far away, a new force will soon arise. Yes, it's Star Wars Land, and it's coming to Disneyland in Anaheim. Crews have already begun clearing land on the site for a 14-acre project. Some of the attractions will include getting behind the controls of the Millennium Falcon.
Oh, that actually sounds very interesting.
Disney are not revealing too much, however, but the artist renderings look truly out of this world.
I see what you did there.
Thank you. Well, listen, we're up to that part of the show where we like to throw you a little bit of a true or false. And today's true or false is really quite simple. It's celebrating the release of Jason Bourne. Jason Bourne, the amnesiac killer spy, is based on a true story?
True or false? A great question.
True or false?
Can I answer after we talk about what we're about to talk about?
You should, because I'm now going to take us into the land of now showing and we discuss love and friendship. It seems that most weeks at cinemas marks the return of something we've already seen before. For example, just take last week's show. If you missed it, you could already have seen it before, or you could go to the bigpicturewebsite.com. We discuss the comebacks of Tarzan and Ghostbusters. This week, the often adapted work of Jane Austen is back on our big screens. For our first now showing choice, Love and Friendship is a delicious serving of elegant manipulation and whether it is possible to see life through any other lens.
Sir James Martin, vastly rich, rather simple.
How jolly. Tiny green balls. What are they called?
Peas.
If my daughter were not the greatest simpleton on earth, she'd be engaged to him now.
But, Mama, I can see Sir James is a kind man, but marriage is for one's whole life.
Not in my experience.
May I present Lady Susan?
Delighted to make your acquaintance.
He's handsome, isn't he?
In a calf-like way.
Mannerings in town.
Have you seen my husband?
Horrid woman. Deranged. But if she were going to be jealous, she should not have married such a charming man.
Just makes me want to talk posh.
Will Jane Austen fans be tearing their bonnets in fury? Feel the need for a strong cup of tea after this?
I don't think so, Mark. And my mum is a massive Jane Austen fan.
Of this show will know. We've had her on.
That's right. I wish I'd been able to take her to see this. So I will speak on my mum's behalf and the many Austenians that are out there. And I would say that this adaptation of one of the lesser known works of Jane Austen, the Lady Susan novella, which is basically a collection of letters joined together to make a book, Lady Susan now turned into Love and Friendship, I think they're going to love it. Mm. I think so. And maybe that's because I really liked it. And I'm not a huge fan of Jane Austen. I like a lot of her productions and I admire her writing and situations, et cetera, et cetera. But I'm not a hardcore fan. But I found this really, really enjoyable. I think the title is super lame, though. Love and Friendship doesn't really tell you much about what's going on. I think Marriage and Manipulation would have been a much better title for this movie. Love and Friendship just sounds a bit, doesn't sound as vicious and as attacking as often this movie can be in a very polite English Jane Austen way. The lead character is played by Kate Beckinsale. She's Lady Susan, who is basically a self-professed schemer. And of course, across the course of the movie, she's attempting to get herself back into or keep herself in the comfortable lifestyle which she's become accustomed. She wants that not just for herself but for her daughter, but she basically just wants that because she wants that, not because she wants the best for her daughter or what she thinks is the best for her daughter is just having heaps of money and a rich husband, not falling in love and that kind of thing. So in and around Lady Susan, you've got Australian actor Xavier Samuel playing Reginald, who's like this young guy who's besotted with this older woman, and plenty of other people that she's effectively trying to manipulate into all of her grand schemes.
Well, Austen's age was one of church going and Bible reading. Does it kind of affect the plot?
It does a lot, Mark. I found this very noticeable. Maybe that's because I'm a guy who often when I go into movies, as we talk about on the show a lot, I like to pick up on things that have got something to do with Christianity or the Bible and then that sort of stuff. And it wasn't very difficult in Love and Friendship because steadily, as you just mentioned, Jane Austen times, this is set back in like 1790 in England. This is a time when all of society, whether you believed it or you didn't, was sort of immersed in the Bible. And it's quite fascinating to watch how people weave God's word and teachings and truths throughout their life. You get references, like humorous references to everything from the 12 commandments as opposed to the 10 commandments, 12 commandments, and people mistakenly placing where the obey your parents command comes from. And the wisdom of Solomon comes up a lot as a description. It's usually not anchored in anything in particular apart from people and particularly Lady Susan. And we should point out Kate Beckinsale is fantastic as Lady Susan. My goodness, she is funny. Like some of the stuff that comes out of her mouth is horrendous, but deliciously funny at the same time. And a lot of what she has to say, when she plucks stuff from the Bible, like obey your parents, she's just basically trying to force people to do what she wants to do, not use the word as it's intended.
Yeah, well, of course. So does Lady Susan's way of seeing the world actually win through?
How do you talk about movies without giving the end of the...
I don't bother, I just give it away.
No, you do that. So I'm trying not to do that by saying I don't think overall Love and Friendship upholds the way Lady Susan sees the world, as funny as it can be and very witty The dialogue in this is fantastic. I'm sure a lot of it's taken from the novel, but the writer and director of this, Whit Stillman, has done a fantastic job, I think, of bringing this to screen. So there's a lot of things in here to really dive into, even though it's very difficult to hear, particularly when it's people deliberately scheming on other people, not for love, not for anything, but trying to feather their own nest. In contrast, though, there's Frederica, the daughter of Lady Susan, who effectively by the film is upheld, or at least more upheld than Lady Susan is. It sort of presents Lady Susan as an out-and-out schemer. Frederica, on the other hand, you see how virtuous and how honest and how loving a woman she is. She kind of recalls to mind something like Lady in the Bible. You get 1 Timothy 2, there's a teaching in there about women, how they shouldn't just be going after elaborate hairstyles and gold and expensive clothes, and it's about what they have on the outside, but it's more what's coming from the inside and how does that affect your behavior and the way you see the world and how you interact with others. I think Frederica is more like that. I think love and friendship overall upholds that. You're not meant to be like championing Lady Susan or getting in her corner.
So even though you have a good laugh at Lady Susan, you come out with Frederica's
side. I think you do. For me, the film actually sort of tapered off a little bit towards the end after being so funny, at least for an hour, maybe a bit more. So I think my only criticism is it does die off a little bit, but you can walk out with this strong message about looking to live the way that Frederica does, not Lady Susan.
Well, if you're ready to laugh along with Jane Austen, Love and Friendship stars Kate Beckinsale, Xavier Samuel, and Chloe Sevigny. It's resplendently rated PG for mild themes and is now projecting itself at a dainty motion picture house nearest.
Charming.
Okay, so before we got to that review, I posed you a true or false, a rather simple one, really. Jason Bourne, the amnesiac spy killer, is it a true story?
Yes.
Wow. You knew.
Oh, that's true? No, that was just a guess.
Well, when I say yes, okay, there's a little qualification here. See, Jason Bourne's name was based on the real-life case of Ansel Bourne, a preacher who lived in Rhode Island and was the first documented case of dissociative fugue, which is a condition not unlike identity disorder, you know, multiple personality disorder. Well, one day in 1887, he forgot who he was, started a new life in Pennsylvania under the name of Brown, and opened a convenience store. And then about 3 months later, he woke up and not only remembered his life as Bourne, but forgot all about his life as Brown. Needless to say, he was quite confused about why he was in Pennsylvania, and to my knowledge, he didn't try and kill anybody over it. But there you have it. True
wow.
story.
Why doesn't someone make a movie about that?
They did. It's called Jason Bourne.
Thank you very much. Still to come on the show, why Batman the Killing Joke is not what you probably think it is. And later in the show, Mark is going to deliver his personal top 5 Star Trek moments.
Welcome back. And celebrating the release of the next Star Trek film has never been easier or more welcome on The Big Picture, because it gives us an excuse to play this.
Life, Jim, but not as we know it, not as we know it, not as we know it. It's life, Jim, but not as we know it, not as we know it. Captain.
There's Klingons on the starboard bow, starboard bow, starboard bow. There's Klingons on the starboard bow, starboard bow, Jim.
Star Trekking across the universe.
On the Starship Enterprise under Captain Kirk.
Star Trekking across the universe.
It's life, Jim, but not as we know it, not as we know it, not as we know it. It's life, Jim, but not as we know it, not as we know it.
There's Klingons on the starboard bow, starboard bow, starboard bow. There's Klingons on the starboard bow, starboard bow, Jim.
Starship Captain James T. Kirk.
Ah, we come in peace, shoot to kill, shoot to kill, shoot to kill. We come in peace, shoot to kill, shoot to kill, men.
It's worse than that, he's dead, Jim. Worse than that, he's dead, Jim. Dead, Jim, dead.
Well,
It's life, Jim, but not as know it, not as we know it, not as we know it. It's life, Jim, but not as we know it, not as we know it, Captain.
There's Klingons on the starboard bow, starboard bow, starboard bow. There's Klingons on the starboard bow. Scrape them off, Jim.
Star trekking across the universe.
Oh, it's such a pity to cut that short.
There's more of that?
Yes, it just goes on and on. Look, Star Trekkin' is a parody song of the original TV series and was released in 1987 by The Firm. I believe it was their only big hit.
They probably just retired off the off how much they earned on that song.
Well, it's a compilation of catchphrases from the TV series that became science fiction cliches in their own right. Like, you know, Uhura saying there's Klingons on the starboard bow and Spock saying it's life, Jim, but not as we know it. Interestingly, Spock never actually said anywhere in the Star Trek series it's life, Jim, but not as we know it. Which just
I'm personally offended at that, Mark. I can't believe they were lying to me in that song.
Well, there's the power of the song that's popularized the phrase, so now it's entered popular culture. Everybody thinks of what he said. The song was hugely successful at roller skating discos in the 1980s, says our producer.
Mate, okay. you are so pumped for Star Trek Beyond on screen. Is there any excuse you can get it into our show, like the top five list that's coming at the end?
I'm absolutely excited about what's coming up. Please stay for the rest of the show.
Batman has experienced something of a resurgence for adults and kids alike over the past decade, Mark, largely thanks to the efforts of director Christopher Nolan and his Dark Knight series, with no thanks at all going to Arnold Schwarzenegger for that Mr. Freeze performance should just never speak of again.
It gave me a shiver just thinking about it.
One of the big pluses for TV audiences has been Warner Brothers' Batman, the animated series. It's filling tween and teen audiences' slots, and it's introduced a whole new younger generation to the story of the Caped Crusader. This week, there'll be a limited release of the first spin-off film.
I want to talk. I've been thinking about you and me. About how this is going to end. About who will end up killing who. Perhaps you'll kill me. Perhaps I'll kill you. You know that, don't you?
Whoa, Mark, there are a whole lot of killy references in that in that clip. But I understand the kids really are into this Batman animated series. And so we've got a movie spin-off, The Killing Joke, which is a like kind of concerning title in and of itself. But there's this movie spin-off. So I would have thought that a movie spin-off from the animated TV show would actually be a good choice for families, wouldn't it?
Yeah, you would think that. I mean, the television series itself and the film, beautiful Art Deco-style animation, bringing the well-received sort of PG version of the TV series to the big screen. But families should be very careful before buying tickets or the DVD that will come out shortly afterwards, because this is the first cartoon film in the United States to receive an R rating.
Oh,
no
really?
Surprise, it's earned an MA15 plus over here for strong animated violence. It unveils the backstory of how the classic villain the Joker came to be Batman's homicidal nemesis, and I think it lends a little bit too much on the homicidal tide. The film doesn't hold any of its punches. It's a classic case of a very adult film in kiddie packaging.
But are you surprised at this? So they've taken a kid's property and turned it into something of an adult fantasy. Are you surprised that they've done this with this Batman animated series?
Not really. This is basically a trend that has been going on now for about sort of 15 years. I mean, if you like, I like to use Shrek as a kind of a benchmarker for this, and it doesn't sound anywhere near as serious, but basically the idea is to expand as much of your audience base as you possibly can. And so producers started to realize that what they could do is multi-layer a film, you know, so Shrek was very much a kid's comedy, but with lots of adult jokes. It's one of the first sort of kids' comedies to sort of get into that. And so there were two levels that the film was working on. Well, hey presto, this can be done on action levels as well. So Transformers was probably the thing that got my ire the most when this series was redone. You basically had...
Got you angry about it?
Yeah, because you had very much a children's product. It was being sold as children's toys. You could watch the Transformers cartoons. And yet anybody who watches the Transformers franchise will realize this is in no way suitable for children, certainly for children, you know, under 15. Okay, you've got sex scenes, you've got graphic violence, you've got sort of simulated violence with robots having their spines torn out and you know, lubricating fluid flowing everywhere and all that sort
so
of stuff.
So do you think that the same sort of thing has happened now with this spin-off movie, Batman the Killing Joke, where effectively a lot of families now are in some pretty difficult territory where their kids might love the animated series, and it sounds like you don't think that's such a bad thing. That like makes sense that they're into the Batman animated series. But now they're being confronted with this spin-off that seems deliberate in it, at least it's ramping up into the adult territory. What are parents going to do now?
Yeah.
Like, are they in this real bind of the kids like knocking down the door saying, we've got to go see The Killing Joke. What are you going to do?
Yeah, look, I think it's never been harder. I mean, that's the problem. Actually, I have my second son is just an absolute Transformers addict, for example. So every time Transformers film will come out, he says, when are we going to watch it? When are you going to watch it? And I say, when the DVD comes out, and I can fast forward through various scenes and pause and send you out of the room and maybe just cut the end of the film off or something like that.
Oh, so you mean it's never been harder as a parent trying to help your child make decisions about the movies they watch, but even you as the parent deciding what they're going to watch?
Oh, absolutely. It's part of the problem. Okay, so yes, when you're watching it with them, it's very, very difficult, and you've got to actually help moderate their expectations because they're not too... They're basically victims of this various process. They're being told that this is a kid product by everything they see in every other context, and then they go to watch it and they're exposed to stuff that they really shouldn't. But as a parent, it can be even harder because you're... being duped by the same sort of approach, you're thinking, oh, well, that was safe enough to buy them the toy, so why wouldn't they be able to watch the film?
And now, there could be a lot of parents and caregivers listening right now that are super surprised at what you're saying about Batman the Killing Joke. Have you got advice for them now, once they get over the shock of where this movie spin-off is going? Have you got any advice for them about how they handle this situation?
Yeah, look, it basically begins and ends with be discerning. Look, I am a time-poor parent. Okay, like every other parent who's probably listening to the show, you ask yourself, how can you manage this? But it's not worth the alternative. You really do need to spend some time going through the films or the programs, at least seeing something beforehand. And it might turn out to be, or at least, gosh, if only there was a radio show or a podcast or something to tell you what to think about these films before
you
actually
watch them. Where could we find something like that? That sounds a lot like, oh, I've heard about this thing, The Big Picture.
Well, God will provide at some point.
It sounds like The Big Picture.
But it is basically going to be a time-consuming exercise. To some degree, yes. We have to be much more aware of the fact that markets do not care about your child's age. They're trying to get dollars. Now, I'm not saying, by the way, that The Killing Joke is a bad film. I mean, people who are fans of that style of animation might say to themselves, oh, this is really good and I like that. But what I'm saying is it's a deceptive product. We've got to be very careful. Kids' products are getting grimmer and grimmer. And the result, if we let it just flow through to the children, is basically sleepless nights and anxieties and fears about things they should have no right being fearful of at this particular age. Now, the good news is later on in the show, we have somebody to help us with that. We've got a psychologist on to talk about how to manage the stress with your children. So please hang around for that.
Batman the Killing Joke is actually at cinemas tonight, like for a special one night only screening. So if you didn't know and you're old enough to go, well, you probably already missed it. So, you know, sorry about that. But for cautious fans, though, it will be available on Blu-ray from this Thursday. But as Mark has said, it's no kid's gift. It's got a strong rating of MA15+ for its strong animated violence.
And still to come on the show, we've got Our Kind of Traitor with Ewan McGregor, our latest spy film, plus my top 5 Star Trek moments. History will be made on radio today. You should be there. Welcome back. Before the break, I let us know about how Batman, The Killing Joke, isn't the family-friendly animated movie you might think it is. You probably thought it was going to be anyway. Well, during the week, Ben interviewed an expert about the common situation of children being impacted by movies or TV shows. Lynn Worsley is a prominent Sydney psychologist and a director of the Resilience Centre. For our press record segment this week, Ben asked Lynn how parents and caregivers can respond when youngsters see stuff that basically traumatises them.
Lynn, thanks very much for joining us on The Big Picture.
Pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Now, we've recently finished up on the school holidays, and it might have happened that parents and caregivers, when they were taking the whole family along to the cinema, maybe they went and saw something like Finding Dory or the BFG, some of the bigger movies that are around at the moment. And even if the whole family knew what they were in for, even if, say, they'd read the book of the BFG, they might have got into the cinema, and at different points in that movie, some of the members of the family, particularly the youngest members, might have been really scared by some of the stuff they saw up on screen. So we thought we'd come to you, Lynn, for your professional advice on what advice can you give to parents or caregivers after one of their kids has seen something that's really traumatized them? What can parents and caregivers do to help their child?
Okay, well, first of all, I want to jump in and just start analyzing the term trauma or traumatized.
Good. I'm glad you're asking me questions. Thank you.
Yeah, we really need to be a bit more careful about using that word, because there are people who are traumatized all over the world from massive trauma, and children who are traumatized from trauma such as war zones and, you know, being taken away from their parents and all sorts of things seeing things that are dramatic. Going to a movie, that seeing something that is like that is like what you would call vicarious trauma. So they're watching something that's happening.
That's a big word. So that basically means watching something else happening.
Yes, and it's not actually happening to them.
Mm.
And so when we have actual vicarious trauma, you're watching it in the real, really, as in the flesh, like you're watching it, but it's not happening to you.
Yes.
When you're watching a movie, you're another step away. So it doesn't actually cause trauma, but it causes upset.
Okay.
Children are upset, but they're not traumatized.
Okay, so it's a good point to start then, not using the word trauma like I just did, and talk more about you're upset, how can I help you with being upset?
Yes.
Okay,
And that watching that situation has upset you, not traumatized you.
Mm.
And it's quite a difference in the reactions. And also, I think as parents and caregivers, what we need to be able to do is to keep it in perspective. Because children get upset about all sorts of things, and they get upset about things that are minor, you know, a little cut, a dog barking, little things, and then it is the parent's reaction to that upset that gives them the information as to whether it's worthwhile being upset about.
Okay. But which can be difficult as a parent or as a caregiver if your child is really, really, really upset. It can be difficult to control your own reaction to that, can't it?
Yeah, that's right.
But you're saying that's very important to do that.
Yes, it is.
Okay.
And so that's why it's important to actually give the child the perspective that it was only a story, wasn't real. And also, yes, it was really upsetting. It was sad what happened to that person, and it was sad what happened to the other person. It was really mean. And that, and getting upset and having some emotions about that will actually help them to develop some compassionate about it.
Mm.
So if they're upset and they're crying, you can use the situation to enhance their empathy building, because they're feeling it. They're having an emotional reaction to it.
And what about in the circumstance of if they're scared?
If they're really scared, again, you use that fear and turn it around so that the child's actually starting to hear that fear as being they're feeling it for another person.
Right,
so they're
right.
not frightened themselves. So it's actually, you weren't there, you were watching it. It wasn't you in there, you weren't in the movie, but you must have been feeling frightened for that character.
Wow, I think that's really helpful advice, especially for parents who are trying to work out how to actually deal with a child's, you know, attack on that sort of issue.
Yeah, very true. And next week, on next week's show, Mark, everyone should be tuning in, because I'm going to ask Lynn whether kids should or should not watch the news. That's going to come up on next week's show.
Imagine you're on holidays in an exotic place like Morocco. You have dinner, and you strike up a conversation with an imposing but charming Russian bloke. Within days, you're being interrogated about your involvement in an international plot involving money laundering, Russian mafia, and high-profile English leaders. Sounds like the ideal holiday, really. Our kind of traitor puts Ewan McGregor in just that predicament. But this adaptation of a Jean Le Carré novel proves to be more about compassion than cover-ups.
I need your help.
Help you? What can I do?
I'm a teacher.
Give this to your MI6. Tell them you have a gift from the number one money launderer from the Russian mafia.
Is this all he gave you?
Yeah.
He told you he was a member of the Russian mafia. And you still agreed to help him.
I thought I could just hand it over and be done with it. He said that his children would be killed if I didn't.
You believed him?
Can't stop thinking about him. His family.
Never before have we had an informant this high up in Russian organized crime.
So, Mark, Ewan McGregor's playing this guy called Perry, and as that trailer indicates, after he's on holiday with his wife Gail, played by Harris, gets swept up in this international espionage within weeks because he befriends this bloke called Dima, played by a great actor called Stellan Skarsgård, who's this Russian mafia bloke, who gives him something. And then upon returning to England, lo and behold, Perry becomes the center of this massive international espionage operation that somehow involves the Russian bank and British MPs and possibly creating this kind of worldwide criminal bank.
Hmm.
Yeah, that is our kind of traitor.
Yeah. Well, where does it sit in the wide world of spy movies?
Well, it's not really in competition with Jason Bourne that's coming out this Thursday. It's not the sort of rough and tumble, quick edits, loads of action spy movie that we might expect from Jason Bourne or from even the Bond series. It's much more low-key, and that kind of model of spy movies we used to get into the 60s, 70s. This is based on a John le Carre novel, so it's more like Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, which both of us love, that movie, the recent movie version that came out 4 or 5 years ago. It's more in that kind of mold, so it's a lot of people sitting in rooms often or passing things to each other, or, you know, looking seriously at each other about the espionage that they're about to get into. It's that kind of spy movie.
It's more thinking than it is action.
The thinking person spy movie, even when it's directed by a woman called Susanna White. You may never have heard of her name. That's because the last movie she directed was Nanny McPhee Returns. Yeah, and she's doing our kind of trade, and she does a pretty solid job of it.
Yeah, they're a big change in direction. Look, spy movies usually test credibility. Does this one bend the realm of reality?
Yeah, no, not so much bending the realm of reality. It does, you know, it is anchored in real life, so that's good to see. But where it does stretch credibility and, yeah, bend the boundaries of reality is the more that Perry and Gale become agents with the British government, that starts really to strain credibility. So they're put in increasingly testing situations. They haven't had any training, and yet they're often sent into like meetings, or they're meant to, you know, get some information from this person while they got the earpiece in, and then sometimes they've got to smuggle out a family of a situation. All of this stuff that I would have thought people that have had years of training, like, say, James Bond might do. Instead, this guy who's a literary professor and his lawyer wife get stuck in the middle of these massive international espionage meetings, and then they're expected to pull it off. And then there's also the contrivances.
Without even a martini to help them.
No, without even a martini, Mark. And so you get all the contrivances too that you tend to get in this kind of movies. Like, why do they get more time at a sports club so that Perry and Dima, the Russian guy, can kind of talk in a back room? Like, why don't people then sort of just come kicking the doors in and suspect them? Because a lot of what they do, Perry and Dima, is very suspicious, particularly from the Russian side. So it did lose me on the credibility stakes on a bunch of different factors. Maybe not so much when it comes to Dima. Stellan Skarsgård is excellent. He's a guy people would have seen in movies like Mamma Mia. He's probably he's the main attraction in this. Damian Lewis is great as a co-star who's one of the British agents. He's like the main boss man. But Stellan Skarsgård is really surprisingly credible as this Russian mafia caricature. But he also has an amazing loyalty and bond with his family that you can buy into for the most part. It gets a little bit exaggerated, but often through our kind of traitor, it's driven by what he wants for his family and why he's doing what he's doing.
Oh, wow. Okay, so our real world does remain sort of troubled by issues of border security and terrorism. Does our kind of trader want to comment on what's going on around us?
A little bit, but not so much. So you get comments about how blood money will win and, you know, people doing dodgy things, even at government levels, let alone at mafia levels. People are out to just feather their own nest. It's all about greed, and that there's a lot of spies and other people around the world trying to break that down and basically serve up justice wherever they can. That comes through, but I think more strongly, Mark, and weirdly, for a spy movie, our kind of traitor, I think, is about compassion, which I'm still a little bit gobsmacked by, and it's one of the things I liked most about it, even though I found it a bit questionable. So Perry is very compassionate towards Dima and what he wants to do, and particularly what Dima wants to do for his family. And yet you get really no character background, no real information about why Perry would make this decision, put his own life in danger to do what he does to help Dima. And even though Dima has only picked him because he was the only guy around at the time and he seemed like he was a trustworthy bloke. So I was very struck by this idea of compassion that runs through our kind of traitor, and how it can remind you that in all kinds of situations in life, it can be very difficult to demonstrate compassion. And I think a lot of Christians would know this very well. You look at the example of God, you look at the example of Jesus and how compassionate they can be towards us, even when we've done the wrong thing. As humans, it can be even harder to extend that. Our kind of traitor has this incredible outlandish position that it's presenting, and yet at the center of it is a hero who is actually driven by compassion. I came out thinking a lot more about than about the fact that I just spent 2 hours in what was a fairly mediocre but all right spy movie.
Okay, well, if you're up for a mediocre spy movie, Ewan McGregor, Stellan Skarsgård, Damian Lewis and Naomi Harris star in Our Kind of Traitor. It's now showing at a cinema near you. That's not a top secret, that is. So neither is the fact that it's rated MA 15+ for strong, coarse language, not to mention several strong sex scenes, so beware.
Mark Stewart, come on this show. We are going to explain an almost unexplainable science fiction classic in 3 minutes, and then it's finally time for you to unveil your top five Star Trek moments.
I can't wait. Welcome back to the show. And before I unveil something very close to my heart, the top five Star Trek moments, we want to explore another part of the movie universe. Among all the films that are set off our planet, 2001 A Space Odyssey is one of the most famous and possibly one of the most baffling. I mean, admit it. If you have seen it, you probably didn't understand it. And I'm a card-carrying sci-fi member.
Yeah. Come on.
Okay. So to help us all get what on earth 2001 A Space Odyssey was on about, Insights editor Adrian Drayton spoke with Ben in the vault this week. And Ben gave Adrian only 3 minutes to get it done.
It's a bit of a seminal science fiction film. For those of you who don't know, it was written and directed by Stanley Kubrick, and it was co-written by Arthur C. Clarke, who wrote a short story called The Sentinel of Eternity. Which
he's like a really famous science fiction author, Arthur C. Clarke.
Basically, the sentinel in the short story is the monolith. There's a big, shiny black rectangle in the film called the monolith.
Yeah.
And so the monolith is a alien device which has been monitoring human existence.
Okay.
So the film begins at the beginning of human existence with the monolith present.
That scene with like the ape men going crazy, yes?
Yes. It's an alien observation device. It goes through history. We get to the point where the main guts of the film is a mission to Jupiter where they've discovered the monolith out in space.
The monolith in space? So are you trying to say, Adrian, that 2001 A Space Odyssey is more about this monolith than it is about the space odyssey itself, or even about HAL, the famous computer at the centre of the movie?
It is indeed. The monolith represents a look at the whole of human existence. And the...
Whoa.
Yes. So it's present throughout all of humanity. And the mission to Jupiter, where they actually discover the monolith, is the point in human history where they've gained enough technology that they can move into space and find the monolith in its original point of time, I suppose. Once humans get there, using the technology that they've built, which is HAL, and he's kind of a bit of a red herring because he wants to kill them off in this mission because they're kind of lazy and they have to sleep and they waste time, all the humans on the spaceship. He works to get rid of them, then the humans, due to their great curiosity, actually kill HAL off and are able to head into the heart of the monolith and travel into the area that the aliens have created for them to kind of explain human existence.
Okay, smart guy. Explain to me then, at the end of 2001 A Space Odyssey, what is with that giant space baby? You know what I'm talking about.
Yes, I do know what you're talking about, a giant space baby. At the end of the film, the human person goes into this white room and he's in the presence of the alien technology that was the monolith, and he's given a look at his own mortality because he ages, and then he passes into the fifth dimension and becomes reborn as a baby in space.
Going back to my original question then, what is 2001 A Space Odyssey about, in your opinion, bringing all of those things together, the monolith, human existence, space babies at the end?
The film is really, like all science fiction, a speculative look at human existence. What lies ahead? What lies beyond death? I think the film, although it's got a lot of weird visuals, it articulates that quite well.
Giant space baby!
For me, other films have really used a lot of the kind of fifth dimension space travel as an emotional journey themes.
Like what?
Interstellar, Contact, WALL-E even uses that whole idea of technology taking over humanity and human existence reaching a point where they're kind of a bit useless. But yeah, for me, the whole film is a great discussion starter about what it means to be human and our existence beyond death.
Well, So much for that. Now I'm much, much clearer.
Mate, now everybody knows the answer to what on earth 2001 was about. And it only took 3 minutes.
Look, we're really thankful to have people like Adrian as part of the show, and particularly supporters like Eternity Newspaper. I actually want to draw your attention to their cover story for the July edition of Eternity. These players don't pray to win. It's an amazing insight on NRL players who pray before games. And in particular, the West Tigers chaplain, who says that the main thing he hears people praying about is that God would be seen through the light in which they shine. Totally unexpected for me. Well worth a read for you.
And because you're still puzzling over how great Adrian's segment was and how did he do that and how did he explain 2001, go to insights.uca.org.au for more of Adrian's writings on movies, as well as Russell Matthews and many other reviewers. They review the latest films every week from a Christian perspective. Go and check them out.
Old Ben, we finally arrived.
Mark, you know I've been waiting all week to hear you talk more about Star Trek.
Here it is. This week, in our top five, in preparation...
You're so excited you can't get your words out.
In preparation for the release of this year's biggest film about a starship called Enterprise. Yeah. I thought we could all benefit from reliving those great moments the Star Trek franchise has given us over the past 50 years, Ben. 50 years. But apparently some naysayers think that our radio audience isn't up for 50 highlights of such groundbreaking epic television.
Thank goodness we don't do a top 50.
So thanks to those Philistines, I've been limited to five. Five, which I found extremely difficult to manage.
Five.
This is where I'm going to begin. The Starship Enterprise giving birth. Do you remember that? Episode 196, Galaxy's Child.
Sorry, what? The ship itself gave birth?
Ben, who could forget the moment where in which the Enterprise's phasers were used to perform a cesarean section on a vast floating space beast? Don't laugh. This is the miracle of birth. Yes, as they used the phasers to cut their way through so that a new child could be born in space. The miracle of life in a void.
Four.
Where can you possibly go from intergalactic cesarean laser treatment? And that's only number five.
Well, I'm telling you now that that is not the greatest moment.
Oh, it isn't? No.
But one of the better moments of Star Trek, one I particularly loved, was, of course, Season 2, the original series, Episode 21, The Nazi Planet. Yes, when the crew of the original Star Trek visited Ekos in the M43 Alpha system, as I'm sure you know, and discovered a world that was completely resembling Nazi Germany in 1938. In every respect. I mean, what were the odds
of landing on that planet?
Yes, I know. And there they were, and everybody was marching, goose-stepping around, as I might say, and they didn't know what to do with it. Lots of shenanigans and crises developed until Kirk realised that the way to solve this situation was to draw their attention to the fact that they actually looked like Nazis.
And when the whole world hadn't noticed up until that point.
When he showed them a picture, they were all very sorry.
Three.
Now, personally,
I know I shouldn't be laughing so much at your serious Star Trek moments, but I'm just gobsmacked in the universe of Star Trek, which evidently I don't know nearly as well as you, Mark, and haven't shaped my entire life as they have yours. I am finding some of these ideas so outlandish that I can't help but laugh.
Well, let me help
Please entertain me.
Let me take you a little further. Star Trek The Next Generation, of course, was an epic television series.
Of course.
I'll prove that a little later to your disdain. But one of the greatest moments of television history was found in Season 3, Episode 26, when we actually visited that well-known television show, The Best of Both Worlds. Now, you might not think much about this, but I'm going to tell you that it basically... It provided you a living. Let me see if I can actually explain this to you. Captain Jean-Luc Picard, played by Patrick Stewart, becomes captured by a cyborg race called the Borg, and he's transformed into one of them. He then becomes the enemy, leading an attack on the Federation itself and on Earth. It was a thrilling episode, but just don't take my word for it. It was the first episode of Star Trek that won an Emmy Award for Outstanding Art Direction and Outstanding Sound Editing. The story appeared in TV Guide's 100 Most Memorable Moments in TV History, and ranked number 50. Okay, well, at least it got halfway. And the episode also ranked 70 on the 100 Greatest TV Episodes of All time. And in 2008, a little rag called Empire Magazine rated Star Trek The Next Generation the 37th on their list of 50 greatest TV shows of all time and cited The Best of Both Worlds as the show's best episode ever.
Well, Mark, also that little magazine you might like to call Empire that I used to
Weren't
work at.
Weren't you an editor for Empire magazine?
I was. That is true. In the latest edition of Empire, there is a list of the top 25 moments in science fiction screen history. And that scene that you're talking about, or that episode,
worlds?
The Best of Both Worlds, turns up somewhere around 13 or 14.
Look, I feel completely justified.
Two.
But no more so than when I consider that great moment when Spock was caught in a dilithium chamber and died.
A dilithium chamber?
Yes, and died.
A dilithium chamber?
Yes, and died. That moment where in which he has his hand pressed against the glass and there's his great mate Kirk on the other side and Spock says those immortal words, "I have and always will be your friend."
International tears were shed at that moment.
Yeah, I incorporated that in our wedding vows.
Seriously?
No.
Seriously?
But I did wear the ears.
But you considered putting it into your wedding vows. What was that from? What movie was that from?
That was actually from, The Voyage Back. Oh, gosh, you got me.
Something like that. It was such a memorable moment. I can't remember what it was in.
I'm still taken by the tears.
It's basically its own movie now.
One.
And here we are at the top Star Trek moment of all time from 1991, Star Trek IV's The Undiscovered Country. Everyone comes together, all races, to discover God in space, who appears to be...
Oh, finally, they found it. They worked it out after however many years of trawling around the universe.
Apparently, he's been waiting in this space anomaly, right? You know, off in the Alpha Sector.
Oh.
Anyway, so what does God want from everyone when he gets them all together?
I give up.
A spaceship. That's all he wants. Would you mind bringing me a spaceship? Now, this is really interesting because William Shatner, as Captain James T. Kirk, realizes a profound truth that the Bible has been trumpeting for 2,300 years. Well, actually, it was the 23rd century, so I'm kind of extending the Bible a little there.
But not the bit about the spaceship, I
take
it.
Here's the truth he realizes.
Okay.
At least by his time, that we need God. God doesn't need anything we could give him.
Profound.
So, yeah. Mm. So this can't be God because God doesn't need us. We need him.
This starship, could it carry my wisdom beyond the barrier?
It could, yes.
Then I shall make use of this starship.
It will be your chariot.
Excuse me.
It will carry my power to every corner of creation.
Excuse me, just like to ask a question. What does God need with a starship?
Bring the ship closer.
I said, what does God need with a starship?
Jim, what are you doing?
I'm asking you a question.
Good question, Jim. Good question.
Yes, indeed. There's a better understanding of God than you'll get in most science fiction films. Okay, well, Star Trek Beyond is what we'll be talking about next week.
And also, Mark, we'll be talking about a new horror film, Out of the Darkness, Lights Out.
Plus my personal identity factor, Jason Bourne.
You mean you are often confused with Jason Bourne?
Well, I think Jason Bourne's often confused with me, but I don't like to bring it up at parties.
But still, next week, I won't be Jason Bourne. I'll be Ben McKechnie.
And I'll be Mark Hadley, but a lot buffer.
The Big Picture is a Bible Society Australia production, sharing the light of God's Word into every corner of your world.